Welcome to another weekly edition of Chatting with Charlie, hosted by Charlie Johnston, with his co-host, Dr. Joe Brickner, and presented by the Corps of Renewal and Charity. Visit us online at corac.co.
Good day, our next bright steppers, and welcome to Chatting with Charlie. I am Charlie. I'm the guy you're going to be chatting with. Joining me, our co-host, Joe Brickner. Joe is, number one of our regional coordinators. He was a corporate executive for many years, and then he wanted meaning in his life. So he decided to go teach college students. And he figured, okay, some of this teaching is harder than it looks. So he was the men's basketball coach at Benedictine College for 12 years. Now, thank goodness, he's retired, except the man still plays basketball. And he is... he and his wife are regional coordinators for the Kansas-Nebraska region of CORAC. He's also a published author, and I tell you, he's got a new book out. We'll talk about that later. And the book is great, but I'm telling you, it's got a great foreword to it. I know. I wrote it. Today, we're doing our 7 questions. That's where we invite readers to submit questions, which Joe then asks me. And I got to be quick on my feet now. I won't pretend like I get them just today. I get them a day or two beforehand to cogitate, contemplate, think about all of these things. So without further ado, Joe Brickner.
Hey, Charlie. Thanks. Well, we've got 7 questions for you today, and they're all over the board.
Okay.
Some are spiritual, some aren't, but I'm sure your words of wisdom will help these folks, not only the folks that asked them, but the folks that are listening. So first one is from Cynthia, and Cynthia says there's a huge focus from a lot of the people that she knows on kind of taking care of things now, knowing that the storm has hit and it's going to get worse and worse, and protecting ourselves against things that the Lord has planned. And she says, is that a lack of trust in God by our trying to prepare all these different things so that we aren't experiencing the bad parts of this? Is that a lack of trust in God? Should we actually do that?
Yes. It's a good question, though, and it's something that I worked hard from the get-go to. I do not have a lot of sympathy with survivalists, because people who are working as survivalists probably won't. You know, I often say, Joe, that the most important form of currency, the most important thing you could do is make friends, people that you rely on and can rely on you. The thing is, when you get to hard times, a lot of people want to look inward. You know, they want to protect themselves. They want to just about them. Our focus at CORAC has been to look outward. It's not that you should never do any preparation, do anything like that, but you need to do it as part of a community working together. I mean, just as an example, were the people who went into the catacombs to avoid being martyred, were they failing to trust God, or were they doing the normal things that you're supposed to do? We're supposed to be God's hands and feet on earth. If it's just for us, focused inward, we're not doing God's will. But if we're working with each other, forming communities and working as a community, that's exactly what we're supposed to be doing. A couple of years ago, David DeLive and I were talking, and he asked me, He said, you know, I appreciate the work that you've done for the pro-life movement behind the scenes. I mean, it's been invaluable, and I'm really grateful for it. He said, but you know the things that God ultimately is going to set things right. So why do you work so hard? And he knows how hard I work on it. And I told him, David, well, when God does show his hand, I want him to find me with my shoulder to the plow, not sitting back in my easy chair and waiting for him to fix all the mess that I made. Mm-hmm. You know, when you got a kid that's messed up his room, You don't grumble and go and clean it for him after he gets to a certain age. You make him. He ain't doing anything else until he cleans that room. So the question actually is very good, because people tend to, especially when they're fearful, they want to look inward. That's not what Korak is about. Korak is about looking outward and giving people the tools they need to work together. That's not failing to trust God. That is doing God's will. Beyond that, though, for all, you know, one of the things that I've said to many people, I don't care how much or how little you prepare. Prudent preparations are fine in my book. You know that my only preparation is I carry a loaded backpack with me everywhere I go. That's it on the thing. It's like wealth. If you prepare, but you would be perfectly happy that you would not lose heart if all those preparations were taken away from you in an instant, then you are set, then you are okay, particularly if it's geared towards others. If, on the other hand, you think you've come up with a plan to replace what God's plan is, you're headed for serious trouble on this stuff, you know? That's so that's really his fun.
Yeah, that's
but it looks that's pretty much my answer now.
Okay.
Any clarifying questions or anything?
Well, I know recently, especially recently, you've been emphasizing with all the Korak leaders that we need to be there for others.
Mm-hmm.
And forming community groups. They don't even have to be Korak members, but they could be neighbors and other family yeah. members or whatever, that when everything does really go bad, that we'll be there, our structure will be there to help them survive, as well as help right. ourselves survive. And I kind of look at it like, you know, we build up different things, food supplies and things like that. And, you know, it'd be enough to get us through a certain amount of time. But if others don't have food, we do. And we're going to be able to provide that food for them. And that we just have to trust God that what we have is enough for all those people in need, and that we won't run out.
Yeah, we'll find a way. We may run out, but we'll find a way.
Yeah.
That's what foraging is all about. We've got to give people the tools. You know, I think about this, Noah and the ark. You know, God told Noah to build an ark. God didn't say, trust that I'll carry you through the flood. He had to build the ark. At the same time, for a couple of years before the flood, all his neighbors were like, man, what a lunatic this guy is. And then when it started to pour, they're all wanting to get in. Basically, that's part of what Korak is doing. We are working to build a big enough boat so that we'll have room for as many people as possible as the flood becomes undeniable.
Well, that's great. All right, let's move on to the next one. This is Jerry. And Jerry's asked some good questions in the past. And this one's a good one, too. He said, why would John the Baptist, when he was in prison, he sent his followers to Jesus to ask Jesus if he was the one or they should look for someone else, when John the Baptist was the one that baptized him and heard God the Father say, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased? So why would he send off his followers and say, is this guy really the one?
I love that question. First of all, Jerry, and I know this is Jerry McFadden.
Right.
And he asks me basic questions that people should be asking themselves.
Right.
You know, I love the questions he asked me. And I love this question because that piece of scripture is one of the most consoling scriptures to me that I've ever read. I've spoken about it to my priests before, and the thing is, we tend to make the great heroes of the past into two-dimensional caricatures instead of real, living, breathing people. When I read that question, John the Baptist, it's not just that he baptized Jesus. In his mother's womb, he recognized Jesus and leapt for joy.
Yeah.
But John, like all Jews of his time, expected the Messiah to be someone who would establish a temporal kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what Jesus was looking That's not what Jesus was doing. For anybody, if you've been called to a particular mission, particularly if you hear it the way that John the Baptist did, and some others that are called to a mission that has supernatural overtones, if you're reasonable, if you're rational, you can't help but debate within yourself for a long time. Is this real or am I just a nut? And there's serious consequences to it too. If you're just a nut, you don't want to go around troubling people or maybe messing up their lives and all that. That's a real risk. You have to take a lot of things, preventative measures, to protect others against yourself, particularly if you're a charismatic figure. Now, you'd think the easy way would be, I'm not going to do this. No, you can't do that either, because if it's an authentic call from God, then you're saying no to God. Not a good thing, you know? So you struggle and all that. In this, you see some real struggles with St. John the Baptist. Yes, he had lived his mission well. He had lived his mission fully. But when he was, you know, facing death, when he's in the dungeons or whatever it was for Herod kept him, John is looking and he's asking, man, this isn't what I expected at all. You know, this was not what I was looking for. Yeah. Has my life, what I hear John asking is, has my life had meaning or am I just a nut? And then you think about the response that Jesus gave him, sent back. Yeah. How consoling that is. Jesus didn't tell him yes or no. He told his the disciples to tell him what they see. People are healed. People, the blind, regain their sight. People are fed. New hope rising everywhere. And I think, you know, John, at that point, he went to his desk saying, this definitely was not what I expected, but it's greater than what I expected. But let me tell you, you know, on one of my projects, Joe, I hope I live long enough after this is all done. I've got two projects that I really want to finish. One is my contemplations, my little stories. I printed a few of them up there, all tied to the rosary, because it puts flesh and blood on these people. They did not serenely go and just think, oh, God told me to do this, so I do this. God told me to do that. They did not sacrifice their free will or moral agency. Their heroism is in that they struggled to do the most right thing they could, not knowing with certainty what it was. So that's why this is. I mean, you think about, I'll tell you another thing. You know, I wrote recently in the article about a great, when I sued the newspaper and won, I laughed after they libeled me for about a year running. And all, somebody a couple of years later had said to me that in a political conference that, look, you don't mess with people who buy ink by the barrel. And I, you know how it is when my button pushed, I said, I did, and I won. People who buy ink by the barrel don't mess with me, baby. But when you're in that sort of a maelstrom where they intentionally put evil, vicious rumors about me, I mean, that was the whisper campaign. It wasn't even much of a whisper campaign, more of a yelling campaign. And where you had the newspaper doing that, you're under so much pressure and you start wondering. My attorney, who's a dear friend who did that, he told me at one point that he was hearing that, you know, when I was married, that the police were always over at our house, that because of domestic violence and all of that sort of stuff. He said, is that true, Charlie? I said, no, it isn't. But I had been under so much pressure. I said, I don't think I have blackouts, but I don't remember anything like that. It's never been that. And he told me, he said, well, he said, you know what, you sign this authorization and I can get your complete criminal record if there is one. And then he calls everything. So I said, yeah, I'd like to find out if I'm secretly Mr. Hyde sometimes. he looked at, he went and got it. Next time, you know, he called me and said, there's nothing there. Again, they're just making it up as they go along. But even as they were making it up, a part of me, I was besieged so much, you wonder about your own, you know? Are you seeing things clearly? So this is the way real people work. They struggle. If they're healthy, they struggle to do their very best, but they have doubts sometimes, you know? And you wonder. And for anyone who has devoted their life to something, at some point you have to ask yourself, well, you've probably been asking yourself for a long time, does my life have meaning, or am I just a nut? That's what St. John the Baptist was asking here, and Jesus gave him a great answer.
It is. Well, you know, I've been watching The Chosen. I think you recommended that to us a couple years ago, and Connie says, hey, we need to watch this. The Chosen is an absolutely wonderful, wonderful program.
Isn't it?
And, you know, the thing that it really brings out to me is how misled the Jewish people were in thinking what the Messiah was going to be, you know, that he was going to be this great military leader, was going to take over, and he wasn't, you know. And I think The Chosen does an absolutely great job of showing how in real life how that could happen, and how he goes about explaining to folks, no, I'm not the military leader. You know, I'm here to change things. I'm here to change hearts. And it's just a fantastic show. I know last night was the final episode of season 3. And it was great. It was just what a great series that is. And, you know, when they finish one, you have to wait about 6 to 8 months or even longer for the next year to come, and you're just chomping at the bit waiting for the next one, because they're just so good, so real. And and I think that's kind of what you're saying is, you know, life isn't this black and white thing that you see on paper all the time. Life is, it's different,
and it's not two-dimensional. It's much greater than that.
Yeah,
think about yourself. And one of that, with all the Jews' expectations having been so wrong, you would think it would lead many of us to think, where are our expectations wrong in this time? Because we leap to conclusions. I've come to the conclusion that God likes to do this, not because he wants to deceive us, but because he wants us to understand that you ain't going to make it by your reckoning and your magnificent intellect. You're going to make it by doing the best you can and trusting me. Mm. You know?
Yep. Oh, great. All right, let's move on to the next one. This is from somebody I know. Her name's Connie.
Is she big? Is she into tiny sandwiches and flying by any chance?
She's into big time, yes. She wants you to repeat the information about the rapture and when it happens.
Okay, the rapture, as it's currently understood, does not exist. No Christian, Protestant, or Catholic believed in such a thing up until 200 years ago, when escapes my mind. I can tell you who came up with the idea. He was a former Methodist minister, and he did that. That's the first time it was ever brought up, okay? So this is one of those man-made inventions. However, Revelation does speak of a rapture. It's after the battle is over, after the sheep have been separated from the goats, and then everyone who has been saved will be caught up. But this business of, you know, driving down the truck, on your truck, and all of a sudden you're gone, and the fellow riding in the passenger seat with you, because he's such a bum, is still going to be here? No. The tribulation we all must go through. And when we go through the tribulation, the way we show our love for God is by helping others. Gosh, where have you heard that before? You know what I'm saying? So the rapture is something that's actually and somebody may want to correct me, it's actually a kind of a minor event after everything has been done. It's just a technical way of getting people into heaven,
okay,
taking them physically to heaven. So, yeah, but on the business of the rapture, as it's taught, or as you see in books and movies, ain't so, and no Christian up until just about almost exactly 200 years ago ever thought of such a thing.
Okay. Thanks. Sure, appreciate
it. Is that clear?
She will appreciate that. Well, since she actually had two questions, and
okay,
since I'm the host and I have to
and
live,
since I didn't know that she's big on tiny sandwiches and flying monkeys, she gets two. The last one was the flying monkeys question. Now let's get to the tiny sandwiches question.
All right, she's got a friend who's a Jehovah's Witness, and she's trying to explain to her that, you know, the Catholic faith, and the Jehovah's Witness is basically trying to explain to her what they believe in and everything. And she said, she keeps getting this question from the Jehovah's Witness saying, what is God's name? And I think it stems from the fact that in the Old Testament, God was called a lot of different things, Yahweh, Adonai, Jehovah, Rama, Jehovah, Raha, depending upon, there's a lot, about 10 different Jehovahs that they call.
And I think they all translate to I am.
Yeah, I looked up a couple of them, like Jehovah Raha, or R-A-A-H, and it's the Lord, my shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they all have my Lord this, my Lord that. So Connie's problem is when this gal asks her, what's God's name? And Connie says, God. Is there anything else that she can say to knowing the background of this person?
God, Harold Divinity. Harold is his middle name. Little known fact. No. And I'm going to say something that may trouble some. There's a lot of very good people who are Jehovah's Witnesses. But Jehovah's Witness is completely a fraud, and they defrauded their people. The way it was started, again, I don't know what it is about former Methodists. This whole thing was created by a former Methodist minister. I've been through this a dozen times. What he did was he took the King James Version of the Bible and he rewrote it to put his emphasis in. But he did most of the rewriting, kept it as is, but just changed particular passages. One of the favorite tactics of Jehovah's Witnesses is to give you one of their Bibles and say, go ahead and read through it. It's just like ours. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, it is. But it is. At crucial moments. For example, William Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet. Now, if you used the exact same language, except that in the end, Romeo and Juliet live happily ever after instead of dying, you'd have some beautiful language in there, but it ain't Shakespeare.
Mm.
Okay? For example, in John, in the Gospel of John, it says, it says that in the beginning was the Word, you know, and in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Jehovah's Witnesses are actually kind of a Jewish heresy rather even than a Christian heresy. He changed that passage to say, in the beginning, the Word was with God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. Now, he insisted that he translated from the original Greek, but in a Canadian libel suit, he was put on the stand, and he was asked, given some Greek text, and asked, okay, if you're fluent in Greek, translate it for us. He couldn't do it. He didn't read Greek. He didn't speak Greek, but he was a flim-flam man on this stuff. And I know this is going to upset a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses when they see it, but it's simply the truth. I do hold the proud honor of, on two occasions, and then they never bothered me again, sitting down with Jehovah's Witnesses in that, my house, and scaring them away by the questions I turned back on them. I think they put an X above my lintel after that. It's just nonsense. And the thing is, when you're arguing with people that are determined to stay with stuff that frankly does not hold up to examination, if they won't examine, I don't waste a lot of time with them. Now, as you mentioned, Connie, it's a friend of hers. I once had a fellow, a colleague, a guy that I worked with that was a Jehovah's Witness. He was a wonderful man. And I didn't go out on my way to try to aggravate him. But on the other hand, Joe, a couple of times when he tried to take a pass at me, I did go right back and ask him the questions and give him the answer. And he figured, you know what, it's better just to get along rather than arguing about this. What's God's name? I mean, everything is a version of I am. And why is that important? His name is God. God, H, divinity, the agent for Harold.
All right, thank you. Christina wanted to know, you talk about the next right step often, and she said, what advice do you have on discerning what the next right step is at any given moment? How do you decide what the next right step is?
Okay, I like that question too, because how do you know what the next right step is? You don't. God insists that you get some skin in the game. You've got to use all your heart, mind, and soul to determine what is the most right thing that you can do, and then do it. Knowing that with all of this, you're going to make mistakes at some. Sometimes you'll make a lot of mistakes, even if you do this scrupulously. You do the most right thing you can, you take responsibility for it. I hate it when people tell me that they're doing some dumb, stupid, offensive thing because God told me to. No, he didn't, you chump, and quit blaming God for your stupidity. You know, do the most right thing you can think of. And then take responsibility for it. When you make an error, and you will, acknowledge it. Don't be trying to convince everybody that your error was actually right all along. Acknowledge it and then move on. The thing is, if you do this, always acknowledging God, when you do make an error, he'll correct you. He'll gently lead you back to where you need to be. And you shouldn't look askance too much at the errors you make, because often God has something for you in those. Just think about it, Joe. How many times with something that you thought was a disaster in your life, you later come to realize that was a turning point, and I wouldn't have gotten to where I needed to be without that having happened, you know? So take responsibility, do the most right thing you can think of, always trusting to God. And here's the great thing. You know, I do a lot of work, created a few things. I have no trust at all that I won't screw it up. But I have complete trust that as long as I keep acknowledging God and working, that he will draw fruit from the things, because he won't make a mistake. So that gives a great deal of confidence. And finally, one image that I'd like you to think of. God wants you to act. He doesn't want you to just sit and talk. He wants you to act. You think about a rowboat sitting in the middle of the lake. If that rowboat is just sitting dead still, man, it's real hard to turn it. Mm-hmm. How are you going to turn it when it's not moving? But it's moving just a little bit. The gentlest touch will turn it in the right direction, even if you start out moving in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. Do the most right thing you can. Take responsibility for what you do, both when you err and when you do well. and trust God.
Very good. Thank you. Let's see. Kate. Kate has a question. She realizes that the storm or the chastisement is we're kind of in it, and she's talking to family members as well as others about the storm, and she's having a hard time convincing people, you know, that there is a storm or that there is a chastisement and that we need to react. She said her family members say that the prophets, that these prophecies have already been fulfilled, and they're Catholic people. And then her non-Catholic friends say, you know, that's just a bunch of hooey. It's in your revelation, but it's, you know, we don't believe in that. And she's struggling with, how do I address both the Catholic family members and the non-Catholics to kind of shake them and wake them up?
Quit trying. I know that sounds shocking, but your job is not to convince people. Your job is to prepare so that when they are themselves convinced by events, that they have some place to go to. Mm-hmm. I always believe in a light touch on that. I'll tell you what I think, and I'll tell you with great candor on that, even when you think I'm a nut on stuff. It'll happen or it won't. When it does happen, I've made preparation to try to help people when they realize and see. It's not my job to convince everybody. I'll tell you something, Joe. Back when I was doing the big time politics and all, even then, I did not waste time trying to convince people. I figured you start off with something that's good, that you can get a movement going on. You'll get plenty of people following. And if you are worried about trying to convince everybody, you'll just get bogged down. I would, and, you know, I can be a little cocky from now on then, just a little. I would tell some of the top people, said, look, I don't care whether you believe me or not. You can either get in on the ground floor or I'll catch you up in my wake later. But one way or another, you're going to come around. And then I move on and leave it alone. That's the thing. When you start trying, you need to tell people what you believe and why you believe it. Once you start trying to convince them, you're getting into a contest of wills and who's right. Don't do that. If you do it with a light touch, if you try to convince them, then even they'll come late, even after they have seen clearly what's going on, you caused them to set their feet in the sand. So they delay even longer to get in there. It's simple enough just to tell people how you see it, what you're doing to try to make things better, and then leave them to their own thing. You know, they'll either come around or they won't.
Well, that's really good advice because, you know, this has happened to me a lot of times where somebody would say something to me and for example, they'd say, well, this here is going to happen and this is what I'm doing to prepare for it. If you need anything in the future, you know, you can come to me. And
I like it.
It just kind of sticks in the back of your head. And then when something happens, I go, oh, yeah, so-and-so said that. And so you go to them for that help.
And right. And, you know, you're not going to get an I told you so. To go back to the Noah thing. Yeah. If Noah spent the time where all his neighbors and all were ridiculing him and all that, trying to convince him that he was right, the boat would have never got built. Yeah. He occupied his time building the boat.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what we should be doing.
Very good. Well, one last question, and it's my own. Unfortunately, in the last couple months, I've had a couple of really good friends who passed away. And they were both in their 70s. Both had successful careers. But neither believed in God. And, you know, I had discussions with them. One was an extremely successful journalist with the Wall Street Journal, New York Times. I mean, he was a big time journalist and he served in the war, in the Vietnam War himself and saw some horrible things. And then as a journalist, he was in six other war zones. So he really saw the worst of everything. And his point to me was always, how can there be a God if he allows this to happen? And no matter how many times I'd say, man has free will. This isn't God doing this. This is man's free will. He'd just say, no, God would, if there's really God, he'd never allow this to happen like this. And then my other friend was into, quote, energy. You know, everything was about energy. He was a Reiki master and all things like that. And in talking with him, you know, I talked to him about, and he was a great supporter of Benedictine College, which didn't make a lot of sense that he supported Benedictine so well, but he believed in his energy and didn't really believe necessarily in Jesus. You know, I don't know. I wasn't there when they died, so I don't know what happened on their deathbed. But if they continued to believe the way they did, can I have any hope whatsoever of their being in heaven or getting to heaven eventually? Is there anything that I can do to kind of pray them there after the fact?
Well, absolutely. I think God writes his law on our hearts. Each of us is given greater or lesser understanding. To whom more is given, more is demanded. I want you to think, for example, of the parable of the two sons. You know, their father told them to go do something. One went, said, I will, went and just sloughed it off. The other one, you know, in a huff, said, I will not. And then he went and did it. God writes the good on our hearts. We know it from our conception, instinctively. If you do the good, even though you don't know the source, you are doing what you can in God's service. I had a dear friend. He was the national spokesman for the American Atheists. He died in a plane crash. I have good hope. In fact, sometimes I ask him, or from time to time, I'll ask him to say a prayer for me from purgatory. I'm convinced that's where he is. And that, you know, people get, and I saw this when I was a kid. People want to make God this nasty bureaucratic guy that's looking for any reason to step on us, to squash us like a bug and everything. He is not. You got to understand what the conception of God is. God wants all of us to come to him. But he will not interfere with our free will. If he did, we would have no moral agency. Mm-hmm. And the only way we could come to him is as pets, not as heirs to his kingdom on things. And then there's the other thing. People think the good is just what is in this world. It's a continuum that goes into the next world. You know, people think the worst thing that can happen is to die. No, the worst thing that happened is for your soul to be lost to heaven. You're going to continue into eternity and that. Now, I'm not a big believer in last second conversions, at least as they're currently understood. I also know that the last moment of life is indeed an eternity. Mm-hmm. And you know many things then that you didn't know prior to that. And you can choose on that, but ultimately the person who tries to do the good as they understand it all their lives, they're in good hands, much better hands than the person that's quoting scripture constantly and is putting their thumb on the scales and trying to cheat their neighbors and all that. So I don't know these men, Joe, but if they were good men, if they were men you could count on, I think you have real good cause to hope that you'll see them in heaven.
If I get there.
Oh, you'll get there. You know? You may have to take a couple of byways and all that. I don't know. You'll get there.
Yeah.
You may need a Connie to get a couple of flying monkeys to carry you that last few.
Well, I'm sure she'd say, well, he's going to have to burn a little while before he gets there.
We you know, you think about contemplations of purgatory. You know, the church says very little about purgatory, except that there is one. Mm-hmm. Okay. And purgatory is a place where we're shed of our disillusions. I mean, I think of it sometimes as the shower room before we can get into heaven. We're shed of all our malice, about, you know, all of those things, those flaws that get to me. But the movie Groundhog Day, that was a contemplation about purgatory. You think about it. Yeah. He started off completely self-centered,
yeah,
and every day having to do the same thing over. He was not released from purgatory until he was living for others,
yeah,
and as a to others. There's several movies that have been like that, that really, when you get to the bottom line, they're contemplations of purgatory. The thing to always remember, God sets everything up to call the most people he can back to heaven. He wants all his children and that. That's why a lot of times when we get frustrated that why doesn't he do this and why doesn't he do that? Because far fewer people will get to heaven if he did it that way.
Mm. You know, one time you said, it wasn't too long ago that I think you said this to us, was there, time doesn't exist with God. Everything's the present with God.
Yeah, everything is now.
And so, but our lives are based on time. And when someone dies, if we say prayers for them after they're dead, to us, it's too late. But to God, those prayers are present to him.
Mm-hmm. Bingo.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Bingo. Well, and, you know, you think about it, what happens? Something that's been really fascinating to me for a long time, and more so in the last year, is the juxtaposition of time, which is a created thing, and eternity, where everything is now, and all of that. We relate. I mean, basically, I think of us as like a little terrarium. Time is for us to get through there. And so then I think, you know, like purgatory, they're not here anymore. They're not bounded by the rules of space. They're still bounded by the rule of time somehow. Hmm. Because in eternity, they're alive on this earth. They're in purgatory and they're in heaven. You know, it's all now on that. They must be bound by time, still with that connection, because otherwise it'd be senseless to talk about any time in purgatory.
Yeah.
And it's, I personally think it's useful to go into deep contemplation about that juxtaposition. I think it's probably impossible for us to really understand it, but we can get some real good insights by looking at it hard. I know once that fellow I was telling you about, the spokesman for the American Atheists, we did a debate on the radio. You know, there had been a debate, and he had called me, a public debate at some church in Chicago. Got a lot of hype, and he said, "Charlie, did you watch it?" Yeah. He said, "I thought they did a lousy job." I said, "Yeah, I thought it was pretty pathetic too." He said, "We could do a much better job." I said, "Yeah, we could." So we set it up and everything. Well, at one point, you've got to get your stuff. He was talking. We were going through some stuff, and on the air, and he said, he spoke about infinity, and I wanted to clarify. I said, "Are you speaking about complete infinity or partial infinity?" And he looked at me and he said, "Infinity is infinity. How can you make that distinction?" I said, "Well, complete infinity has no beginning and no end. Partial infinity may have a beginning and no end, or an end, but no beginning on that. So we need to clarify the terms here." Actually, I could see the way he looked at me then. That was when he knew he was going to lose this one. And he did. We ended it. He did end by conceding that there was a rational basis for belief in God.
That's great.
The thing is, it's important. And you know, our friend Desmond Birch often says that everything that's wrong with the world, and I think he goes too far on this, but he's got a big point. Goes back to bad philosophy.
Mm.
And that's it. You want to learn these things because it gets you closer to what is true. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, Charlie, that's the extent of our questions for this month.
Well, I'll tell you what, Joe. When it's all done and we're all in heaven, God willing, I want you to get your buddies together and let's have a barbecue. Who knows? You might even convince me to play a game of basketball with you.
Yeah, well, both of them were big basketball. One was a good basketball player, and one was just a great basketball fan. He was actually my assistant. I made him an assistant coach. Couldn't pay him. But for 12 mm-hmm. years, he recruited for me in Arizona, and he got some of our best players in those wow. 12 years. And, didn't pay him a dime. I'd fly him in for senior night at the mm-hmm. end of the year every year so that he could spend the whole weekend with, you know, players that he recruited and stuff. And it was great. But, you know, he did that out of the goodness of his heart. He did that. So, anyway,
I mean, that's something. Hey, Kirby, are you in there?
Yes, sir.
Come here. Say hi. I'm staying at the house right now of your counterpart in Region 3, Kirby Bowling. Just come over on this side. Wave it, folks. Say hi.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, Kirby, how are you?
Good.
Great. Just great. So you're putting up with Charlie for a couple of days, huh?
Yeah.
That's right. Someone needs a minder.
Well, I hope you're feeding him well. You know, he's
Oh, please. On these trips, I go up to 205 to 207 pounds. When I get home, usually I'll get down to 190 or 185. But on wow. the trips, I can't diet because every time I blow into town, they kill the fatted calf. And they expect me to eat it. You know, that's what I do.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
The hibernation cycle of, you know, putting on weight and then taking
it off. I
really
do.
Well, it's good to see you, Kirby.
Good to be seen.
God bless. Well, Joe, I guess we're at the end of our, at the end of another podcast.
Yeah, I might remind people that if they do have questions, that they should go to 77questions@gmail.com and send, and I'll get that email. It's 7 spelled out, S-E-V-E-N, then the number 7, and then questions@gmail.com. That comes to me. I accumulate them, pick out 7 of them, and every month Charlie addresses those. So please send your questions in. We love answering them. I love listening to the answers that Charlie gives to those questions. So it's just our way of kind of being able to open it up to the audience to have them have their concerns addressed by someone who we trust. So, Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe. One more thing, and then I'll do the out cue. Where can people get your book, and what's the title of it?
Oh, yeah, my new book. It's called America Lost in Place, and it's available on Amazon. And what it is, it takes a look at America and when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s and compares it to America today. And I pick 17 different topics and compare each one as the 50s and 60s to what it is today. And then at the end, I analyze, are we better off or not? And I think people find it really interesting. People that are our age look back and it's a nostalgic run for them. Sure. They say, oh, yeah, I remember that. I remember that. Those who weren't born back then, they go, was life really like that? And then how it's changed so significantly over 70 years. And mm-hmm. so, you can pick it up on Amazon.com, America Lost in Place.
Yes. And for those of us our age, we were born in Bedford Falls, and it's Potter's Bill everywhere now.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much. Look forward to our next Charlie chat, which should be in a couple of weeks with an unknown guest yet. And every month we do the 7 questions. So looking forward to both of them.
All right. Well, for me, Charlie Johnston, and for my partner, Dr. Joe Brickner, I want to wish all of you, until next time, keep taking the next right step. God bless.
Thank you, Charlie.